Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The New York Mets, they're at it again. Now, let me just preface this by saying, I've got no interest in talking about these people every single day. I mean, I could talk about that tire fire every single day, but I really don't want to. In fact, it's the last thing on my mind. I do not want to do this, but they leave me no choice. Yesterday, it was because manager Mickey Callaway was mother bleeping reporters in the clubhouse. Also yesterday, because veteran starter Jason Vargas allegedly yelled at a reporter, and I quote, "I'll knock you the bleep out, bro," and then had to be restrained by a couple of teammates. So, like, I figured that would be my Mets take for the month, but it's not. And you know it's a bad day when you get hammered by Philadelphia 13-7, and that's the best moment of your day. That's because before the game, Callaway met with the media and was asked if he was sorry for his actions in mother bleeping that reporter. And of course, Callaway handled that about as well as he handles his team, which is to say he handled it terribly. So terribly that it included this.
It's fair to question whether you can handle the ups and downs of the season.
Oh,
you're going to have a public outburst like that because of an outcome. I mean, in fairness,
Dele Martin punched a reporter one time. You know, I mean, it's just part of this game. You know, it's something that I'm a passionate guy about baseball, and I'm a tough competitor. And sometimes you'll see it with the umpires, sometimes you'll see it with the players. And the thing is you guys don't need to see it directed towards you guys. That's you guys have a job to do. I understand that. I've always understood that. And you guys don't need it directed at you. That's the number one thing that I know.
What? That's literally one of the worst answers I've ever heard to an easy question. Billy Martin punched a guy one time, and I've got to be up here apologizing for this. It's not like I killed anybody. What, are you going to tell me that Connie Mack never F-bombed a reporter? I'm sure that John McGraw probably challenged a number of reporters to duels. Yet I'm up here apologizing for mother bleeping somebody. Like, you know it's an amazing apology presser when the presser does not actually include an apology. And the team has to call the media a second time to make him try and get it right and do it all over again. That is the best. And that's exactly what happened. Shortly before the game last night, the media was called back so he could run it back. And this time, he said that he did meet with the reporter, Tim Healy, and he did apologize.
In my meeting with Tim, I apologize for my reaction. I regret it. I regret the distractions it's caused to the team. And, like I said earlier, it's something that we'll learn from. It's something I'm not proud of. I'm not proud of the distraction. I'm not proud of what I did to Tim. For that, I'm definitely sorry.
You might not be proud of it, but I got to be honest, Skip, I'm really proud of you. Because nothing says I'm sorry and I regret it more than needing two shots to say I'm sorry and I regret it. All this guy had to do was apologize and it would have been over. Instead, he cites Billy Martin punching a guy and says he's just that competitive. And since he butchered it so badly, the team had to call all the media back and give him a chance to do it again. So while the manager was lighting himself on fire, Jason Vargas, the guy who threatened a reporter and said, quote, "I'll knock you the bleep out, bro." Unlike his manager, absolutely, unequivocally owned his actions. No, he did not.
I think everybody's aware of the situation that happened yesterday. I think it's unfortunate for all parties, an unfortunate distraction. But tonight we got the Phillies to play. The team's addressed the situation. The organization's made a statement. And, that's really all there is to it. So thanks for taking your time, and we'll see you guys after the game.
Oh, no, thank you. I think it's unfortunate for all the parties. I think it's an unfortunate distraction. Way to own that, JV. That's what I call leading from the front, being accountable and responsible for what you say and what you do. And what you say is, I'll knock you the bleep out, bro. And what you do is run across the room in order to say it. And best of all, this isn't even the most embarrassing thing about this team, because all of this overshadows the fact that Mickey Callaway, the manager, is not actually managing the team. According to the New York Post, GM Brody Van Wagenen is managing the team by text message from his home. Quote, according to an industry source, it was the rookie GM who instructed Mickey Callaway to remove Jacob deGrom from a game in Arizona earlier this month in which the Mets ace sustained a hip cramp. After deGrom was removed from the game, in the seventh inning, the bullpen imploded in a loss that added to the frustration of a 2-5 record road trip. The source said Van Wagenen, who was watching the game at home on TV, communicated with a member of the Mets support staff with an order to remove DeGrom from the game. Callaway complied with the order, and DeGrom was visibly upset as he departed the field, certain that he could continue pitching. End quote. Man, the Mets, they're freaking awesome. It does not get any better than that. Well, at least for me. You tell me what's better than a manager mother bleeping reporters and needing two tries to apologize for it while comparing himself to Billy Martin and saying that putting reporters to sleep is part of the game. And a GM watching the games on television and texting about pitching changes. Only the Mets. I mean, you go across town, I could put the Yankees on the clock for 10 years and none of that would happen, much less all of it. But that's how truly embarrassing the Mets are to themselves, their fans, and all Major League Baseball. I mean, that story should be so much bigger because it's so embarrassing and it's so absurd that BVW is skating right now because Callaway could not handle the basics of a press conference. Unless BVW is texting him and telling him to drop those 12-letter bombs on reporters. Even better, according to the Post, the text that was sent by BVW regarding DeGrom was, quote, get him out of there. Quote, get him out of there. If that's true, that's the best too. I mean, that's like something a fan would tweet, not what a GM would text. And when BVW was asked by Mike Vaccaro about the report that he's managing his manager, BVW's response was, quote, this organization is about teamwork and collaboration and the ability to trust the manager on an everyday basis, end quote. Yet why don't you throw a little blue cheese or Thousand Island on that crappy word salad, BVW? Oh, but then again, when you think of the Mets, aren't those the things you think of immediately? Teamwork, collaboration, and trusting the manager. Of course, all of that. And mother bleeping reporters and threatening them. You guys are the best. I would say never change, but I know I don't have to because you can't change and you won't change because you all think you're killing the game, even as you're threatening to kill your beat reporters. Hey, Mick. Hey, Brody. See you both tomorrow. I know I will. And probably right here at the top of the program once again. Scott Satterfield is my guest. Scott, nice to have you back. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you back. So it's been a little over a half a year since you arrived on campus. You've been through spring practices. Now we're just over 2 months before the season opener. What have the first few months at Louisville been like for you?
Well, just a lot of work. Putting the team within the weight program, getting all those things done as far as trying to develop those guys, getting them stronger and faster, just like everyone else. And really just trying to ingrain our values into our program. I think that's probably the biggest thing with our coaching staff and on a daily basis is just trying to be consistent. And, the guys have been working really hard. They've bought into what we're trying to do here. And, we know it's a lot of work to do. We have a lot of things that have to get accomplished, but I'm proud of where our guys are at this point.
Louisville head football coach Scott Satterfield is my guest. Now, Scott, when you and I spoke last season, you were putting together yet another remarkable year at App State. You had a really good thing going at your alma mater. I know what that school means to you. There was no way you were going to leave unless it was for something really unique or something really special. So what was it about Louisville that attracted you so much?
Well, I think, first of all, I didn't really know a lot about Louisville, but I knew about the ACC. And, I grew up in the Raleigh-Durham area. Around a lot of those teams that have played in the ACC for many, many years. And over the last, handful of years, 5 years, I think, Louisville has done some really good things. Just a couple of years ago, had a Heisman Trophy winner.
you know, top five program in the country when Lamar was playing. And so I just think that part of it, you know, enticed me to want to say, hey, let's take a deeper look into this program. And met with their athletic director, Vince, Tyre, and he's, you know, sold the program to me. And, you know, I was excited about the opportunity coming and trying to compete for a championship in the ACC.
It's summertime. Best time of the year, right? I love summer. There's only one thing about summer that I can't get with. The bugs, the flies, the insects. They're taking over your house, right? I know. I've been there. This is why I want to shout out to my pals over at Dynatrap. Dynatrap is the leading manufacturer of outdoor mosquito and insect traps. And now they've come up with a solution for indoor pests as well. Follow me on this. The Dynatrap Fly Light. The Dynatrap Fly Light works day and night to attract and trap flies. Also fruit flies, mosquitoes, other pesky insects. I'm telling you, this thing works like a charm. You're not still rocking those absolutely repulsive fly strips, are you? The Dynatrap Fly Light looks like a subtle nightlight which plugs into any indoor outlet. Trust me, it works. I've got one. I'm using it. It has trapped an insane number of insects which would otherwise be buzzing around my home. Why do I have bugs? We leave the doors open in the summertime. I live in California. You need to get yours at Dynatrap.com. That's DynaTrap.com. Enter the promo code Rome. Get 15% off any of their products. Promo code Rome at Dynatrap.com. Dynatrap, the safe, silent, and simple solution to household insect control. So, Scott, what about approach? For instance, from a scheme and recruiting standpoint, what you did at App State clearly worked. You had amazing success there. Will the same approach work at Louisville and in the ACC, or do you have to change up and adjust?
Well, I think just the core of what we did at App State, we can win. I believe it can win anywhere. I mean, obviously, this is a different conference. You know, you're in a conference now where – most of the teams are very, very solid. I mean, you know, you look at 5 or 10 years ago, there was probably a handful of teams that the ones you had to compete with, and now, you know, any team in that league can win. You know, with the coaching that they've hired in this league, I think it's an outstanding coaching. So, but I think you can do it. I think, you know, the foundation of our program at App was being able to run the football and stop the run, I think. And that translates into any level, any year. You can go to any era, and you can see how that translates into a lot of wins. And so that's kind of what our foundation is going to be. And you got to be able to get great players. There's no question about that. You know, we see right now what, you know, the Clemsons and the Alabamas of the world are doing with some of the best players in the country that are going to play for them. And so, you know, we have to get great players to come in. And, you know, right now we're getting players that are maybe not the, you know, the very, very best in the country, but we hope they're going to be close. And then maybe in a year or two, they'll be the best.
Louisville head football coach Scott Satterfield joins us once again. You know, there's no denying the fact that the program's coming off a tough season. You know this, but it was not that long ago that Lamar Jackson was winning a Heisman Trophy there, and that team was in the top five. I know that you might not want to put a timeline on this, but what's it feel like to you? Is it going to be a long process, or can this thing be turned around pretty quickly?
Well, you know, as a coach, you know, we're just in the day-to-day process of it, and you never know how long it's going to take. You know, I think we've seen great strides within the program, you know, just in this short period of time that we've been there. You know, we've been hot on the recruiting trail the last month. I think that's shown a sign of progress. You know, we think we've gotten the right players that are wanting to come be a part of our program. You know, then you got to go out there and you got to win some games. And so, you know, right now, probably heading to the season next year, people are not going to be picking us very high or to win many games. But, you know, if you can go out there and you win some games and show that we are, you know, having some progress, then hopefully the next class will be even better, and so on and so forth. And you continue to build that. You know, how long that takes, you know, what that looks like, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, our league as well. You know, how are the rest of the teams doing within the league and the ones we have to compete against? And so, you know, we just take it day by day and try to get the right ones in there that can help us win. And, you know, we feel like we've got a good foundation for that.
Scott Satterfield, my guest. You've got the in-league action, and then you open up against Notre Dame. Obviously, there are easier ways to start a season than by facing a team that was in the playoff last year. But in a way, is there a value in having an opponent like that to start, because that gets everybody's attention all offseason?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. You know, you're going to open up with a team that's every year is going to be in the conversation for, you know, potentially playing for national championships. They just came out, you know, the Final Four from last year. They've done a great job at that program. And so to play those team, you know, all the whole offseason, you know what you got to be ready for. And it's not like, you know, you're playing an SCS opponent or opponent, you know, like that to start the season, where sometimes teams can kind of sleep through maybe the off season. But, you know, we know what's at stake. You know, we're coming off a season last year that was not very good at Louisville, and, you know, defensively gave up a ton of points and, you know, just didn't win many games. So we've got our players' attention, I think, with what we've been doing. And, you know, with Notre Dame coming in here, it'll be a lot of excitement, I think, the first game. We're playing on that Monday night, national TV. So it's going to be exciting, exciting for our guys. We got a lot of work to do, obviously, playing a team like that. But I think you'd rather be it that way than the other way.
Scott Satterfield joining us for a few more moments. You know, when you talk about what you're building there, Court Dennison, who's on your staff, I thought had an interesting comment earlier in the spring when he talked about playing for coaches who did not talk to their players from the moment they left the practice field until they returned to practice the next day. He learned that he was not going to do that. So when you're rebuilding a program, how much of coaching is about scheme, and then how much of it's about relationships and getting the players to trust you?
Well, I think it's probably more so the second, you know, thing that you mentioned there. It's so much more about relationships. And, you know, as athletes growing up, when I was playing, when many of these guys are growing up playing, you want to play for somebody that you care for, that you know has your best interest, and you're going to give everything you have for those type coaches. I've played against for other coaches that you didn't care as much for, and, you know, really did you put much into it. And so the relationships we're trying to build with these guys to let them know that we care, that we have their best interest, and we want them to do the very best and try to pull out every single potential they have in them. I think that's huge. And then you have to be able to play for each other. When you're playing for each other, I just think, you know, talent doesn't win those games. I think there's so much more involved in that. And so that's what we've been focusing on, those other aspects, playing for your brothers beside you. What can you do for each other? How you lift each other up, you know, being positive in a negative world. You know, all those things are the things we've been talking about in the offseason.
Being positive in a negative world is so key. Hey, Scott, what about your coaching staff? Do you try and build that same kind of rapport among the guys on the staff? And is that one of the reasons why you have basketball games with the coaching staff? They're pretty intense games. What is the result of that? And are you trying to build that same rapport with your guys?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, I think it starts with me at the top. And, I mean, we want a program that doesn't have any egos, starting with me. And that filters down to our coaching staff and all the way through our players. You know, when you don't care who gets the credit, you can do so many great things as a unit. You know, a football game is comprised of over 100 guys, you know, unlike any other sport. And so you have to play as a team. You have to play for each other. And that starts with the coaching staff. So we're very competitive with everything that we do. But I love the camaraderie. I've always been a part of staff that like hanging out, that, you know, whether it be, you know, grilling out, you know, barbecuing in the backyard with each other, or playing a basketball game, or playing a game of pool or ping pong. It doesn't matter. We want to be very competitive, but we want to have fun with each other. I just think that translates when it's fourth down in a game offensively, and you're going to go for it. Even if you don't get it, your defense has your back. You know, those things, it translates. And so we've always done that. I think we've always had staff like that, and I think that's always been successful.
Scott Satterfield joining us. Listen, before I let you go, let me ask you about your roster, because one of the things you've talked about is that when you first got there and you looked at that roster, there were a couple of numbers issues. For instance, there were only 8 returning scholarship offensive linemen, but there were 15 returning scholarship wide receivers. What kind of thoughts did you have when you saw that?
Well, I'm pretty shocked, to say the least.
Right.
You know, I truly believe you got to win in the trenches, and so we're always going to be able to recruit our big guys up front, D line and O line. I think that's huge, critical spots. And you know, I think there's a ton of skilled guys running around throughout the country, and you know, you got to get the right ones, but you certainly got to get the guys in the trenches. So we made a concerted effort to be able to do that this off season to try to bring in a bunch of O line, D line. We'll continue to do that over the next few years to try to, you know, build that up. You know, but. That's going to be critical for us, is trying to handle this roster in a way that will enable us to win. And so that's kind of what we're doing. You know, we have some guys that are talented, O-line, D-line right now. We just didn't have the numbers. So we're trying to build those numbers up. Because when you get up throughout a season, you start losing some guys, injuries, and that sort of thing. You better be able to put the next guy in that can handle the load.
He had a great run at App State, 51-24 there. First coach to lead a school from the FCS level to the FBS and immediately earned 3 consecutive bowl wins. Louisville is coming off a 2-10 season, but got their new head coach, and they open up against Notre Dame on September 2nd. Scott, really nice to have you back. Thanks for sharing your thoughts about the program, and I'll look forward to doing it again soon.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having me on, Jim. Take care.
Robert Klemko is my guest. Robert, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. So you've got this long-form piece on SI.com that I've wanted to talk to you about for quite some time, because while you did an amazing job with it, it's also extremely disturbing. The title of the piece, Robert, is You Never Knew Kellen Winslow Jr. So let's go back. Before you started to work on that piece, what was your impression of Kellen Winslow Jr.?
You know, I was a young NFL fan. I was in high school when he got drafted, you know, in the first round by the Browns. And I always thought he was one of the great, you know, would have been, could have been talents in the history of the NFL. And then I started covering the league, and you start to hear these stories about kind of the way he behaved behind the scenes, some of the things that were sexual in nature, exhibitionism, if you will. And you just wondered if any of that stuff would ever get out. And there was really no reason to flesh it out and report on all of it because, you know, what was the hook? What was the big news item that it was tied to, right? And then he's arrested for rape. And then you remember, okay, who was it that told me that story? And then you start to go back and try to piece some of these things together and see if there's a pattern of behavior there.
Robert Klemko joining us. So all of that said, what was it like reporting on this?
You know, there were two facets of it. There was, you know, being at home and calling experts, calling psychiatrists and people who study rape and CTE and specifically rape of the indigent and the homeless. And that was, you know, fascinating in that, you know, I think a lot of people look at this case and say it's really bizarre that somebody of wealth who has notoriety, who comes from a famous family, would go to these lengths and, you know, do what he's accused of and rape women that are indigent, hitchhiking, homeless women and the like. But, you know, what I learned was that it's way more common than, you know, than people really think, because, you know, what rapists are looking for in a victim is not necessarily attractiveness, but vulnerability and the confidence that they won't either be able to go report to the police or they won't be believed. And then the second aspect of it was, you know, going to the actual trial. It was the first ever trial I'd been in, certainly the first violent crime or rape trial. And seeing what victims and accusers have to go through in terms of facing the person who allegedly raped them and telling their story, you know, I think, you know, we all have a feel for what that's like based on television and film, but you don't really understand how agonizing it can be for these women until you're actually there and you're sitting about 30 feet away from them. And, you know, she's facing not only the lawyer who's peppering her with questions on cross-examination, but, you know, she's 15 feet away from the person that allegedly raped her.
We're talking to Robert Klemko. Boy, there's a lot of really interesting things in that response, a lot to unpack. Now, in the piece, you do go back to his time with the Browns and the fact that the team had brought his father to town to film a piece of father and son, but the son could not be found. And then he was found in the back of his vehicle, engaging in lewd conduct with himself. What did the team think of that at the time? And over the course of his career, how unusual was that kind of behavior?
Yeah, I think it was really unusual. Talent we've seen in the NFL excuses a lot of things, right? So if the 53rd guy on the roster can't be found in between 2 days because he's pleasuring himself in the back of his Hummer, you know, he's gone. You know, we don't need that kind of behavior. We don't need that kind of distraction. We don't need that kind of liability. But Kellen Winslow, I mean, people remember who followed the Browns at that time. I mean, he was considered one of the best pass-catching tight ends in the NFL for a couple of years and was growing into a really well-rounded player before injuries sidelined him. But, you know, there were multiple instances of him, you know, being seen masturbating or openly watching pornography, whether it was sitting at his locker at night and an equipment manager discovering him, or sitting on the team plane to an away game, watching it in a seat. Nobody wants to sit next to the guy. Nobody wants to room with the guy. And Phil Savage, who was the GM at the time, pulls off this trade to the Buccaneers. And certainly I'm sure the Buccaneers had no idea what they were getting into, because a lot of that same behavior continued. And you'll remember, you know, the big blow up that ended in Cleveland had nothing to do with this behind the scenes behavior related to pornography. It was him having a shouting match with Phil Savage after a game where he'd just gotten out of the hospital for a staph infection and felt like he wasn't getting enough targets in the offense in a game against Washington. So, you know, there were a lot of things going on with this guy, but his saving grace for his entire NFL career was that he could have been one of the great tight ends in NFL history.
We're talking to Robert Klemko. He's got a long-form piece on SI.com right now about Kellen Winslow Jr. Robert, according to one former assistant, when he was in Tampa, he had a life-sized, anatomically correct woman's torso that he brought with him on road trips. Did he feel like he had a problem? Did anybody else around him think that he had a problem? Or were they just saying things like, that's Kellen being Kellen?
You know, there were people over the course of his career that tried to talk to him about what appropriate behavior was. In Cleveland, there was Romeo Crennel, especially the head coach, and certainly assistant coaches who had not only been familiar with Kellen Winslow Sr.'s career, but played alongside him and knew him personally, tried to talk to Kellen Winslow. You'd hope or think that in 2019, if somebody was exhibiting the same behaviors, that there would be a team psychiatrist available to talk to somebody like that, and that would be mandated in order for somebody to stay on a football team. But in 2004, you know, this is pre-Jovan Belcher. This is pre-CTE awareness. This is pre-Ray Rice. There's just not a lot of medical professionals outside of the training staff and, you know, your orthopedists, your team doctors and surgeons that are available to players. So the coaches are acting as essentially team therapists. And obviously they weren't equipped to handle a player like Kellen Winslow.
I know, Robert, you've mentioned CTE a couple of times. People around Winslow try to use CTE as an explanation for this. What do you make of that argument?
You know, I don't know Kellen. I've never been, you know, around him, never talked to him. I've only seen him defending himself at trial or not defending himself because he chose not to take the stand. But what I learned over the course of reporting is that there was a faction in his family that wanted him to go with a CTE defense because he had changed in mood and temperament and behavior so drastically in the last couple years. You know, the equally plausible explanation for that is, you know, he's a former NFL football player who didn't plan on life after football and he got depressed. And I think that's part of the reason why his defense attorneys chose to go the route they did in trying to discredit each individual accuser instead of the CTE defense. Another big reason that they wouldn't go with something like that is because you can't prove CTE in someone who's alive. You have to examine the brain removed from its skull. And so there's not a lot of precedent for that kind of defense. And the public mood is such that somebody accused of rape in 2019 is not going to be able to, excuse it away with concussions in the NFL. I don't think that people are open to that sort of explanation. Maybe that's something that is possible down the road as we get a greater understanding of the human brain, but certainly not right now.
Robert Klemko joining us again. Robert, let me ask you this. If players talk about politics or they talk about social issues, coaches and front offices will frequently say that they don't want that kind of disruption to team chemistry. Yet here you have a guy who is watching porn in meetings, committing lewd acts throughout the facility, and that's not an issue for team chemistry? Like, how does that work?
You know, it's crazy. You know, I think teams are so afraid of the visiting media and having the CNN truck parked outside. I mean, the biggest nightmare for an NFL team that I can remember in terms of a PR perspective was not Ray Rice or Jovan Belcher or Tyreek Hill or Kareem Hunt. It was the bullying scandal in Miami when Jonathan Martin and I'm blanking on the other offensive lineman's name.
Richie Incognito.
I mean, that was an enormous media story because it crossed lines in terms of going from sports to what was being talked about at the time in the rest of the country, which was bullying. And the Miami Dolphins had CNN and NBC news reporters in trucks parked outside their facility for weeks. And I think that's the thing the teams are really afraid of, when the whole world starts paying attention to a problem in your building. But if you have a guy who's simply masturbating or watching porn at inappropriate times, you can cover that up. Nobody wants to talk about that. And as long as the media doesn't know about it, that's something that you can tolerate.
Now, I wonder what it would be like right now, Robert. For instance, Winslow has not been out of the league that long. So do you think teams would react differently to a player doing this right now? Or would everybody look the other way, literally, as long as that player is putting up numbers on the field?
I think that there would be a scale. You know, I think that there would be less tolerance for it now. I think that there would be more recourse for teams to try to get somebody like that who had a clear problem, some professional help. But I think, again, if it's the 53rd guy on the roster, you just get rid of him. But if it's a star, I think you try to work with the guy and make sure that he still has a place on the team if he can get right.
Before you go, let me ask you this. The context for the piece is the fact that Winslow has been on trial for a series of, hideous crimes. And early on, there's this quote from Winslow to the media outside the courthouse. I'll read you the quote. "To the people who know me out there, who know what type of person I am, know my character, my NFL friends and family, my regular friends and family, they know who I am," end quote. So based on all your reporting about him, what do you make of that comment about his character?
Yeah, that was a bizarre one. And that's actually the last thing that he said in his own defense. And I would counter that by saying that everybody that I heard was a friend of Kellen Winslow, whether they were former NFL players, college friends, mentors, didn't want to speak for the story. They didn't want their name attached to anything remotely close to this, except for Denise White, the woman he had once contracted with to do his public relations and media relations. So, you know, obviously, I think these people were embarrassed to have once been close to Kellen Winslow, and several of them who spoke to me, and that many of the accusations in their eyes were credible.
And then finally, what's his father been like during this process? Has he been defiant? Have you had any time with him? How is he treating this?
Yeah, I think it's been really tough for him, kind of observing him during the trial. You know, he had various NFL friends, including Charlie Joyner and other former San Diego Chargers, coming to the trial, watching with him in the gallery. He was at every day of the trial, whereas Kellen Winslow Jr.'s wife only came for the pretrial hearings and the last day. And Kellen Winslow Sr. was extremely protective. I mean, when we got there, the court officials told us, "Kellen Winslow Sr. has requested that you do not approach the family, that you do not ask them for comment. They're not going to have any comment at any point during this trial." He went so far as to shepherd family members to and from the restroom to kind of shield them from reporters. He was doing everything he could do. I mean, I can't even imagine what a nightmare this must be for him and some of the other members of his family.
He is a football writer for Sports Illustrated, good friend of the program, and the author of a powerful and really disturbing piece on Kellen Winslow Jr. Robert, really appreciate you and appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, as always.
4th of July is right around the corner. You want to prepare your vehicle for the 4th of July road trip right now by going to your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store. Simple preventative maintenance, like changing your oil and filter, topping off engine coolant, and checking belts and hoses, can avoid costly repairs in the future and keep you safe. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts have the parts that you need at guaranteed low prices. So get your car ready for the 4th of July holiday weekend by going to O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices, every day, O'Reilly Auto Parts. You know, it's award season and it's billboard season. I touched on that yesterday. It's free agency season. We hit on that literally every single day. And more importantly, it is the NBA shade season. You see, this time of year, people around the league hint or imply things about certain players, and then everybody loses their mind about the insults flying around. And that's exactly what happened yesterday when Celtics GM Danny Ainge had this to say.
"I think it just makes life more enjoyable when everybody is humble, hardworking, and will play any role that they have to help a team succeed. you do have to have a certain amount of talent to win in our league, as we all know. But good people is it makes coming to work more fun.
Dang, that's a pretty interesting and random observation, right? And the moment it left his mouth, everybody started to trip about him taking a run at a certain player. No names mentioned. It rhymes with Irie Curving. I'm not really sure everybody's getting so bent out of shape about why everybody's freaking out. I mean, everybody would agree, right, with the fact that it's just better to work with people who are good people, unselfish people. I don't even think the guy's talking about basketball here. That rule would apply to any workplace. My workplace, your workplace, a radio program, an accounting office, a janitorial supply company, an elementary school. I mean, anything, right? And if it's Danny Ainge saying it, it does not mean he's talking about a particular player. He's just laying out what's good HR practice. I mean, so why is everybody losing their mind? Maybe the sound or the visual of Ainge saying it directed you. So let me read this back, all right? Forget who said it. Let me read this back. Quote, I think it just makes life more enjoyable when everybody is humble, hardworking, and will play any role that they have to help the team succeed. You do have to have a certain amount of talent to win in our league, and as we all know, but good people make coming to work more fun. Pretty nebulous. Pretty open-ended. I mean, how can you sit here and say that he's talking about Kyrie? Oh, wait. No. He's definitely talking about Kyrie. In fact, if you watch his eyes during that clip, I'm guessing he's probably blinking out the name Kyrie Irving in Morse code. Danny Ainge was practically lighting a Kyrie jersey on fire as he said what he said. He could not have made that any more clear that it was Kyrie if he had tried, even down to the mention of people needing talent to win, but that being good people is more important and to make it more fun, and that this dude was a complete and utter buzzkill. But he wasn't the only one sending subtle messages about free agency and roster management. Andre Iguodala was on CNBC yesterday, and he was asked about his teammates and about the future of Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson. Iggy made this prediction.
I think they'll both be back with the Golden State Warriors. We're like brothers. Wow. We keep in contact. But regardless of any of that, if both did decide to leave, they would still be my brother. I still keep in contact with them as much as possible. And I just wish the best for both of those guys. They come back full strength.
You're crushing the Knicks fans here with this kind of
Nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry.
So, of course, he's going to say that he expects Durant and Klay to re-sign with the Warriors. I mean, why wouldn't he? Number one, he might actually have some insight into both these guys, seeing as to how he plays with these guys, and he's a team leader, and he's played alongside of them for years and won with them. And then even if he didn't, even if he was completely in the dark about what they were going to do, there's no way he's going to show up and say, yeah, they're gone. Yeah, I don't think we're going to keep these guys. But that wasn't even the best part of the answer. Did you catch that at the very end? Underneath the over-the-top laugh of one of the hosts, Iguodala just absolutely threw one down on the Knicks. Dunked on the Knicks. Quote, nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry.
Nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry.
Nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry. Let me repeat that. Nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry. Like, my man just dunked on the Knicks, and he's still hanging from the rim 16 hours after he threw it down on them. That's got to sting, Knicks fans. Because ever since the Kristaps trade, this is what you've been building towards this summer. The chance to bring in KD and Kyrie. And yet it's been one blow after another. Like not winning the lottery. Which might have given you the chance to get KD, Kyrie, and AD. You lose the lottery, KD gets hurt, and you miss on AD. And Kyrie is taking his non-team-based approach to the Nets, apparently. And Andre Iguodala is dunking on you and standing over you at the end. I mean, that's got to suck, Knicks fan. Ariel Helwani legendary Knicks fan, came on this show just over a month ago. He made a bold, bold prediction. He said he wanted me to play it back again in the future. A little more than 5 weeks later, I can make good on that. I'll play it right now.
And Jim, remember, basketball is back in New York City. When they win the championship in the next 5 years, play this clip. You'll say that I was right.
Next 5 years or next 5 weeks? That's Ariel. This is Andre.
Nobody's going to the Knicks, sorry.
Why don't you try to run that back-to-back, Alvin? Here is Ariel talking about the Knicks and how things are going to change.
And Jim, remember, basketball is back in New York City. When they win the championship in the next 5 years, play this clip. You'll say that I was right.
That's my man, Ariel. Here's my guy, Andre.
Nobody's going to the Knicks, sorry.
Nobody's going to the Knicks, sorry. He appears on a TV show in New York City where they're all hyped up on the Knicks. If you know anything about the Knicks, you know he's right. Nobody's going to the Knicks.
Nobody's going to the Knicks, sorry.
Not Zion. Not AD. Maybe KD. Maybe KD. Not Kyrie.
Sorry.
Sorry. Nobody's going to the Knicks. Sorry, Ariel. Sorry, Knicks fans. Nobody's going to the Knicks. Maybe KD.
Sorry.
But after the injury, maybe not. He is Will Brinson. Will, how are you?
Oh, man, I hope everything's good.
Good, man, good. So yesterday you had a piece on CBSSports.com about the top five players that you would build a franchise around. You had Patrick Mahomes number one on the list. How easy was that choice, and what would you say to anybody who took issue with or disagreed with it?
Yeah, it was real easy, and it was sort of based on the premise. We'd done a mailbag episode for the podcast, and somebody, a Browns fan, wanted to know if Baker was the number two guy on that list, and even he, you know, acquiesced and said, look, I'm not insane. Patrick Mahomes is number one. And I think it's an easy choice. I mean, the guy is in his first year as a starter, came out and he threw for 50 touchdowns and 5,000 passing yards, which put him in a pretty elite club. You know, he's making no-look passes out there. He clearly has as much athletic potential as any quarterback we've seen in recent years. And I don't know what you're high on, but I don't want any part of it. If you pick somebody other than Patrick Mahomes, if you're starting a franchise for the next 10 years right now.
Will Brinson, my guest, but how do you explain it, Will? For instance, he's only played a total of 17 regular season games. He's only 23. He's already a league MVP. He's already been to the AFC Championship game. I mean, being a quarterback in the NFL is one of the toughest jobs in all of sports. So how do you explain the fact that this guy's literally mastered it or close to it so quickly?
Well, I do think that Patrick Mahomes, Jim, is a great example of why situation matters when you're talking about the NFL and we talk about quarterbacks. Like, you know, we can say, oh, well, you know, this guy is a tremendous talent and he landed at the right spot and that's great for, or, you know, he has all the arm talent, he has the cerebral abilities, that's great. But, I mean, you have to land in the right spot. And I don't think that Patrick Mahomes could have landed in a better spot. When he came out from Texas Tech, you know, the book on him was that, you know, he was an athletic freak who could throw the ball a million miles, but he certainly had some, you know, some Brett Favre to his game in a negative way, that he was going to throw some picks, make some crazy plays, make some big mistakes, force some balls into coverage, and then he was a little bit unrefined and raw with a ton of upside. And because he landed in Kansas City, not only does he get to play for Andy Reid, who has shown that he's a quarterback whisperer over his entire career as a head coach, but he got to sit for a year behind Alex Smith, who was, you know, he was a borderline MVP candidate in 2017, but B, he was a willing and able mentor for Patrick Mahomes to help him learn the system. And so I think all of those things accelerated and shot-putted Patrick Mahomes into the position that we saw in 2018, and that helped make him league MVP. Doesn't hurt either, right? You got Travis Kelce, Tyreek Hill, Kareem Hunt around you. I think that's why, you know, it wouldn't be surprising at all if we saw a little bit of, you know, drop-off from Mahomes. You know, Kareem Hunt's not going to be there. Tyreek Hill, I think everyone would be surprised if he played a full 16 games. Kelce a little banged up coming off, you know, injury. And Mahomes, according to Football Outsiders, one of the luckiest quarterbacks in football in terms of should adjusted interceptions, should have been interceptions, basically. So I think we'll see a little bit of a drop-off, but he might drop off to 4,000 passing yards and 40 touchdowns. That's life for Patrick Mahomes.
Will Brinson joining us. All right, so in terms of the list, you had Baker Mayfield second on that list. You and I have talked about him in the past. I've made it clear I am all in on him and the Browns as America's team. What did Mayfield show you in his rookie year?
Yeah, I'm with you. I would again, I wouldn't take him over Patrick Mahomes, but like I want to go with that hot take, but like I said, you'd be smoking something I don't want a part of. Mayfield just showed an innate ability to step in and be a leader at a very high level on a very short notice. He took over that team that with Hugh Jackson, you know, running things into the ground, and he still went out there and looked pretty sharp. And then as soon as he got some good coaching around him and Freddie Kitchens was able to take over the reins offensively, you know, Mayfield stepped up his game tremendously, and he looked like a dominant young quarterback. Now, there are questions about Mayfield and how he played down the stretch last year against some of the better defenses in the league, but this is a guy that came in. He didn't get any first team reps coming into the season because Hugh Jackson was so adamant that Tyrod Taylor was going to be their starter. And so now he's going to have a full offseason to work on it. He's going to have Odell Beckham. I just think he has, you see it, and only a couple of guys in the league have it, Jim. And I think the list would be Aaron Rodgers, Patrick Mahomes, Baker Mayfield, and Russell Wilson. But for whatever reason, these guys are just the best at moving outside of the pocket without taking off down the field with their legs and constantly looking to extend plays with their arm. And I think you just see it. They keep their platform level. They know how to throw from all different angles and from all different platforms, and they're able to make strikes down the field when moving on the edge. And I think that just differentiates them from so many other quarterbacks in the league. And I wouldn't be shocked at all if Baker was right there in the MVP conversation this year.
Me neither. I expect it. Will Brinson joining us. Now, if you had to say it right now, Will, and I know we don't have a whole lot to go off of, but if you're drawing up a list of franchise players in a couple of years, how likely is it that Kyler Murray is on that list?
Well, you know, he's one of those guys along that same, you know, the baseball guys, right? The ability to throw and run on the move. I think a lot is going to come down to situation for him, too. Look, if Cliff Kingsbury... The problem is it's easy, Jim, to be like, all right, Cliff Kingsbury's got a crazy offense, and it's going to be great. But it's harder to adapt at the NFL level. And I think Cliff Kingsbury's a smart guy. I think he's a good coach. But am I 100% sure that his offense is going to come out and be gangbusters and blow away defensive coordinators, just out of the gates? I don't know about that. I think there could be an adjustment. I'll tell you this. I would be stunned if Kyler Murray, just based on his situation, doesn't put up huge stats either way. Because when you look at Patrick Peterson out for six games, you look at an offensive line that is going to force them to move him around and let him take shots on the field. You look at the pretty good weapons he's got there. I mean, you know, mostly rookies and Larry Fitzgerald, but Christian Kirk, but a pretty good group of rookies there as well. David Johnson, of course. I just think, couple that with the fact that Cliff Kingsbury, whose Texas Tech teams led FBS in total plays run the last two seasons before he got fired, it would be stunning if Kyler Murray just didn't have a high volume statistically. And so I think we're going to see some big numbers, and I think he'll be high on that list. I'm not ready to go there quite yet just because we haven't seen enough of him. But, I mean, he's a guy that could certainly work his way into the top five or top ten when you're picking quarterbacks down the road.
We're talking NFL with Will Brinson. All right, Will, what about the Patriots? They got some good news regarding the recovery of Sony Michel following knee surgery. In a post-Gronk world, how significant is he, Sony, to their offense?
Well, I think their draft choice tells you just how important he is, because when they went out and got Damian Harris out of Alabama, they're basically saying, look, we're investing two high-round picks in back-to-back years on an SEC workhorse running back who we believe can run behind this offensive line. And I think what they're trying to do, Jim, I think they're trying to play a game of hide the Ferrari, right? What they want to do is bunker down, run the football effectively behind an offensive line, keep Tom Brady from having to throw too much in the regular season and get more mileage on his body and take more hits, utilize the short passing game with James White and Julian Edelman, try and work N'Keal Harry in. I mean, it's going to be tough to get a rookie who, you know, to come in as the only first-round rookie ever drafted by Bill Belichick at the wide receiver position and make an impact early. I just think that'll be difficult. You don't have Gronk to stretch the seam and keep teams honest. I think they're going to try and win with running and defense throughout the regular season, you know, work their way with a soft schedule to 12 wins, get a division title, get the first round bye, and try and do, and hopefully get home field advantage, and then kind of unleash Brady a little bit more in the playoffs like they did last year. We saw him, you know, the running formula still worked in the postseason. It worked great, but they were able to, you know, make big plays down the field when they had to. I just think they understand what the weaknesses of this roster are, and right now it's in the passing game and their inability to stretch the field. And so they know how great their offensive line is. They know how great Dante Scarnecchi is at coaching those guys up. And they know if they have Sony Michel, Damian Harris, and that host of receiving running backs like James White and Rex Burkhead, that they've got an offense that can do just enough to win them a division title and get them a first-round bye.
Will Brinson, my guest. Before I let you go, one more thought, one more topic. When you talk about running backs with knee injuries, Will, throughout the offseason, there's been a steady drip of stories about Todd Gurley and his knee. If you're a Rams fan and you see the words like arthritic being mentioned in those stories, how worried would you be?
I think it's a 12 out of 10 on the scale, Jim, when you talk about concerns for Todd Gurley, because his contract, the way that they structured it was basically designed like, all right, he's a running back. Let's get 3 years out of him. He's going to be Todd Gurley. He's going to be great. And they can't cut him. They can't go anywhere with him. And when you see that, you know, they draft the kid out of Memphis, whose, you know, nickname is the human first down, that Sean McVay reportedly believes is the most exciting. Daryl Henderson reportedly believes is the most exciting skill position guy in the entire draft. You know, it makes you think that the Rams don't fully buy into Todd Gurley being able to come back and play at a Todd Gurley level. The other thing that is a huge red flag for me, Jim, is when you hear that Todd Gurley is losing 10 to 15 pounds or wants to cut his weight down, that basically tells you that he's not comfortable running at his current weight on that knee, and that the weight is a problematic issue, or that the knee is a problematic issue, and that he believes if he cuts down on the weight, he might be able to sort of run at his current skill, at his previous skill level. I just don't see how they can treat him as a workhorse moving forward and expect him to be the same guy with that knee injury. You're almost better off just sitting him for half a year, letting him recover, letting him rest, and seeing if you can get him back to full strength at some point. It might already be shot given his knee injury history and given the sort of deterioration that seems to be accompanying this with the arthritic stuff.
Hey, well, I got about 60 seconds. I have to know, how many hot dogs does 70 bucks buy you?
I don't remember the exact number. We were down with my in-laws at the beach for the week on vacation. And there's a place at Wrightsville Beach called the Trolley Stop that's been serving hot dogs for like 75 years. It's this little, you know, little hut down in the corner. It's a sweat box. You go in there, you know, order all the way, surfer dog, whatever you want, you know, Chicago style if you want it. I was tasked with going in and getting hot dogs for a boat full of 9 people. And once you factored in drinks and chips and all the hot dogs, it came out to $69.75. So I think it was probably 2 per person. So we're probably looking between 18 or 20 dogs. Not exactly a great deal there, but some pretty darn good hot dogs.
Sounds great. He is a CBS Sports senior writer. He's the host of the Pick 6 NFL podcast. Good friend of the program, too. Will Brinson, my guest. Will, great job. Thanks so much.
Always a blast, Jim. Take care, man.
You too. Well done. Cam Newton is a celebrity. Nobody would doubt that. Most quarterbacks in the NFL are. It's the biggest league in the world. The quarterback position is the most important in that league. There are only 32 of them. And then on top of that, Cam makes about $20 million a year. So, why is this celebrity with cash stacked to the ceiling on a cell phone video flying coach? How is the man not in first class with a hot towel draped over his mug, getting some Z's on an international flight back from Paris? And the answer is, he missed his flight, which is relatable, right? Who hasn't done that? We've all missed flights. Cam Newton missed his international bird back from Paris to North Carolina. Now, that being said, that's a pretty tough flight to miss, especially when the only plane that he could jump onto was last minute that went through Dallas. So now this guy's adding 2 hours, a layover, and a flight change to his trip home. And the worst part is, he could not get in up front. So all of 6'5" Cam had to pack himself into a coach seat like the rest of us. Had to slum it back there like the rest of us. Except Cam, again, is not like the rest of us. He's got cash stacked to the clouds. So Cam had a plan. And according to multiple people on that flight, he approached this guy in the first row of coach where the most leg room is, and he offered that guy $1,500 to trade seats with him. So imagine Cam Newton not only on your flight, which would be pretty cool, but walking back to be with you and coach, but him not being happy about that, and then offering somebody $1,500 up front to switch seats. Good story, right? Really good story. There's Cam up front where he belongs. The only thing that would make the story better is if the guy he offered the cash to shut him down and said no. Like the guy said, shut it down, get back to coach. Because that's exactly what happened. This dude straight up Heisman'd Cam. So either that dude is one of the richer guys around and doesn't need $1,500, or he's a Falcons fan. The saddest part of the vid is Cam slunking over after getting denied and returning to his assigned seat. What a bleak reality. Wait till they bring that drink cart out and the peanuts. I haven't seen anybody that bewildered on an airplane since Jim Rome was told that he was first on the downgrade list and to get his ass back to coach. Let me tell you, I hope this guy had an iPad loaded up with movies or game tape, because that had to have been the longest 10-hour flight of his life. And remember, it wasn't just a 10-hour flight. It ended, and he had a layover and a flight change in Dallas. Air travel is tough enough. Now you throw in missing your flight, giving up your first-class seat, having to go to coach, getting denied a switch when you try to buy your way out of it, and then flying into a destination which is not yours. I guess there are certain things that money cannot buy. But on second thought, he probably should have dug deeper. He's Cam Newton. He's rich. And how come there was only one guy? There had to have been somebody up front that would have switched for $1,500. But as I mentioned, it could have been worse. He could have been put on the downgrade list. Is there anybody listening who has ever been on the downgrade list? Or am I the only one? Or did they make up that list for me? I just got a feeling, man. I got a feeling there was somebody on that flight, somebody working that flight, that saw me get on or saw the list and saw me, Jim Rome, and thought, oh, hell no. Watch this. Watch this. Watch me hook this guy. We got ourselves a little videotape opportunity. Watch this. You know it was somebody like one of those flight attendants. Either had a brother who was a chiropractor or a mime, professional bowler, soccer player, something. They probably had nothing better to do. Watch this. Check this out. And this guy comes back to me, or maybe it was a gal, and say, excuse me, sir, are you Jim Rome? Yes, ma'am. How are you? Fine, Mr. Rome. Hey, listen, I'm going to have to ask you to go back to row 17. Why is that? I'm in row 2 right now. Because you're first on the downgrade list. Wait, what? What is a downgrade list? Sir, you're first on the downgrade list. Okay, what is the downgrade list? I'm familiar with an upgrade list. What is a downgrade list? When somebody has to go back to coach from first class and you're first on it. Okay. How did I get on that list, and why do I have to move? Because that gentleman over there in row 3 has a broken seat. Okay, how come he's not going back to coach? He's the one with the broken seat. My seat's fine. I'm good. No, you're not, sir. You're first on the downgrade list. All right, so you know that story. More awesome today than it was then. And they didn't get me either. I didn't bite. They couldn't hook me. I did not make a scene. I did not raise my voice. I happily went back there because I knew that Stu had her phone locked and ready to roll. Couldn't get me. Has anybody else ever been on the downgrade list? Has that happened to anybody else? And how awesome did it feel? Cam, you and I have something in common right now. You tried to buy your way into first class and it didn't work, and they ran me back to where you were sitting because I was on the, quote, downgrade list.
Good night, now.